Derby 104.
Well, good morning, welcome. It's Abbey 104 on Sunday morning at 11.05. It's time for Folktales. I'm Terry Bennett. And in the studio this morning, I've got Vaughan Matthews. Good morning, Vaughan.
Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. Now, you are, most recently, your claim to fame is you are a newly elected town councillor for Sherborne, isn't it?
Indeed, for my sins, I am.
Yeah, well, tell us what led you into that field.
Well, I was fortunate enough to retire from Singapore to come to live in Sherborne in 2014. And I have to say, I knew nothing of Sherborne, but it ticked every single box. And I just regard it as a privilege to live here. And it's a complete joy. And it's an honour that people want to come and look at the town where I actually live. And they come and visit and hopefully sort of go to the shops and spend their money. And it's a bubble. It's a wonderful bubble. And it's almost sort of life in England as I knew it. That might be sort of looking a bit backwards, but it's just lovely to live here. And I've now got two dogs, which we can enjoy the walks around here with my wife. And every day is so pleasant. And it's the best thing I ever did, I think, is to come and retire and live in Sherborne.
Lots of people enjoy living in Sherborne, but not too many of them volunteers for the cut and thrust of local politics.
That's true, but I've never been involved in politics, but I felt that I had something to bring to it. I've worked internationally now for so long, and I've learnt a lot of skills at all different levels, negotiating with governments and local authorities, etc. And I felt that I could perhaps bring something to the council with that. And as such, I put my name forward. And I am so grateful for the people that voted for me. There's over 500. And I'm privileged that they chose me. And now it's my responsibility to be their representative on the council and to do what I can to keep the town going forward, but preserving what we have, which is just the whole aspect of the town itself. So that's why I'm there.
But local politics hasn't been your life by any means. You were in the RAF and you've been involved in, well, a family business and also in recruitment as well over the years, haven't you?
Indeed.
Quite a varied and very international career.
Yes, very much
been
so.
Around a bit.
Yes. Mm. But from the political platform, I don't see it as that. I've only been to one full meeting at this point in time, but the people around the table are all there for the good of the town. So I think you can strip away the political colours. And it's more like a board of directors, so to speak, all with their individual skills, all bringing different elements to the table. And if we embrace that and work as a unit, rather than arguing or opposing for the sake of it because we didn't think of it and they did or whatever. The way forward is cohesion. And if we've got that glue, then, as the Chinese say, the fish will always rot from the head down. If we get it right at that level for the council, it's got to be for the good of the town. So I don't see the political battles there, and I don't think politics should come into it at this level, to be quite honest. And I'm pleased that is the atmosphere in the council chamber.
That's good. We'll come back and talk about that a little more in due course. Let's take your first record, which is David Gilmour and Comfortably Numb.
Yes, I think this is just a wonderful, wonderful recording. And if you can see it on YouTube, it's even better. This was the live concert at Pompeii. Comfortably Numb, I think one of Pink Floyd's best songs, but done with Gilmour and Roger Waters also on keyboard. So I hope you enjoy it.
Is there anyone at home? Come.
Well, David Gilmour there with Comfortably Numb, and that was the live version from the amphitheatre at Pompeii in 2016. And if my research is correct, I think it was the first live performance there since AD 79. Can you confirm that, Tim Vaughan?
I was there.
Yeah. It was certainly a great recording anyway. And my guest in the studio is Vaughan Matthews, local town councillor, amongst many other things. And it's actually Vaughan Coleridge Matthews.
It is indeed. Yes. But people seem to struggle with the middle name, so I rather than keep trying to spell it, I just cut through it. And Vaughan or Matthews will do.
Let's go right back to the beginning. Whereabouts were you born?
I was born in Derbyshire, a small town on the edge of the Peak District. And an only child. That could be good or bad, I'm not quite sure. I'm still on the learning curve on that one, I'm afraid. Mother and father worked in the local industries. And I went to the local technical school, which, and going back to the days of the 11 plus, that was sort of almost one notch down from the grammar school, so to speak. But I had a great time. Played lots of sport. I was house captain. I was always good at swimming and athletics, etc., although I seem to have put a bit more weight on since then. So I had a great time, great schooling, great masters, the old traditions. When the teacher would come in, you'd have to stand up and don't sit down until he tells you to and all of that. But it pays off and you learn the basic rules from day one. And that allowed me to sort of gather my qualifications and to go on and then submit my application to go to RAF Cramwell to join the Air Force.
So looking back on those days, then, early school days, good days?
Oh, absolutely.
You enjoyed school?
Absolutely. Mm. I, like all these things, I think at the time, you don't perhaps see that. But in this day and age, you look back at what you were taught and you seem to remember it. We all remember Oxbow Lakes and things like that. The quality of education was so good, and it was so varied and broad that your knowledge was immense on across a wide range of subjects, and the quality of the teaching, I think, because there was respect, there was behaviour in the classroom, you knew the rules, and you weren't allowed to be disruptive, and we seem to have moved so far away from that now, and I think it's really sad. And maybe people say, well, you're being old-fashioned, it's not like that anymore, but I'm sorry. I wouldn't change that in any way, shape or form. Was the 11 plus good or bad? Should people be tested at that age? All we could do was take the test that was put in front of us. And from there on, and I found this in life, certainly within recruitment, there's almost three levels within the human sector. There's people that want to get to the top straight away. The SWATs, I suppose, we would have called them at school, but they were so good, and they were the real high flyers. Then there's the band in the middle that are trying hard, but they need an arm around their shoulder, give them an encouragement, lift them up when they start to sort of flag a bit, and they respond to that. And then there's the bottom feeders that are very happy travelling along, bumping along on the bottom, doing what they want to do without a care in the world or whatever, and they're happy there. And that has gone. I've seen that all around the world with levels of recruitment. And I think it's true to this day. I was in that middle stream. I wasn't a SWAT by any stretch of the imagination, but I enjoyed what I was doing, and I had a balance because I a lot of sport, but then I had to do the work to get my O-levels and A-levels, etc. Yeah, it was tough at the time, but that was the norm. That was the norm. I didn't want... My school seemed to be manufacturing school teachers. That seemed to be the expectancy. I didn't want to go down that route. I wanted something more. And the Air Force, to me, offered that opportunity of excitement and being international. There was no other agenda for me than the Air Force.
At what point did you form that ambition? Because you went on to Cranwell.
Yes.
At what stage had you decided it's going to be the RAF?
I think it was in the early days of the sixth form. I then started to look. Where did I want to go with my life? What were my aspirations? And it's quite remarkable. I talked to my son, I have two sons. My oldest, Grant, at the age of 12, he wanted to be a dentist. I had no idea at 12 where I wanted to be. All I was interested in was the next day. And it's tough now for children, you know, because they've got to make these decisions at a much earlier age to get the plan set to be able to achieve that. In my day, you didn't have to. Yes, there were always jobs, I think, but people stayed in jobs as well. They never really moved around. These were the days of every Wednesday afternoon shops closed. Mm-hmm. and sort of bank managers had lunches and all of that. Yes, it's a bit reflective, and it's sort of days of just William and Jennings, etc. Great days. But life has moved on, and I accept that it has to change. But I didn't start making my decision until, as I say, early sixth form. Right, what do I need? Where am I going?
So you set your ambitions then at going to Cranwell.
Yeah.
Was that a difficult place to get into? Did you need quite
advanced qualifications? You needed the qualifications,
yes.
But once you'd got that, what I found really interesting there was the gap between real high school, public education and public schools. Massive gap. The guys from the top sort of public schools, so confident. They could do anything. They couldn't, but they thought they could. And the rest of us, we sort of stood back and thought, ooh, I'm not sure about this. Well, I'll give it a go. And it made me realise that, you know, you must bring that into your life. If you've got the confidence, you're almost halfway there, then now read up, learn about it, and go and do it, fulfil it.
Did that put you at a disadvantage, do you think?
I think initially it was a wake-up call, like, to the point that if I'm going to go anywhere here, I've got to change my game plan, which I did, and I succeeded. But it was there was a big gap between the two of us. I suppose, again, I didn't join a cadet force, so I had no military experience whatsoever. So maybe I joined the RAF somewhat naive to what was going to happen to me. But they in the Air Force and at Cranwell, they had a tremendous training system in that, so much that they didn't allow anybody to get above the crowd. They would push you so far down that you were below the ground level. And they let you come up slowly and surely. And the minute someone stuck their head up above the pump, bang, push down again. And you were tested. You know, you would have a kit inspection and they would walk in and just throw it all over the room just to test you. I've painted grass green. I've painted gravel. I've cleaned a toilet with a toothbrush because they just push you and push you and push you. Where's your breaking point? And you smile. And you get up and you do it and say, right, what's next? And it's character building.
And I presume that that's deliberately aimed at weeding out those that haven't got that sense.
Indeed.
Of
indeed.
Resolution.
Are you reliable? Will you be there in a crisis? Mm-hmm. Can you think under pressure? Constant testing. Constant. And you look back, it's got me where all that I achieved, I go back to that basic training and man management skills, etc. It trains you for so many aspects of life today, and I'm eternally grateful for that opportunity.
That's interesting. So the training itself lasted about a year, I think, didn't it?
Well, it was a three-year course.
Yes.
I wanted to fly, but unfortunately my eyesight failed because you were being tested almost every 6 months, and my eyesight was starting to go, so I wasn't able to take up a flying scholarship, unfortunately. But I did flight operations, which was sort of controlling all the ground aspects and organising the logistics of that. And I enjoyed doing that, but I wasn't flying. And unfortunately, I thought at the end of it, my friends were then going on to other squadrons, and that wasn't going to happen to me. So I think that was my time to say, well, I've had a wonderful time. And I did have a great time. We did all, because I was good at swimming, I was put into the swimming team. We played water polo and we started the Subaqua Club, went round the world scuba diving, did an archaeological dive off the north coast of Libya.
Yes, tell me about that.
We joined forces with Nottingham University to find this It was a known Greek harbour, but nobody knew where it was. So we were out there under canvas, living in the desert, on the edge of the coastline there. And we'd look for probably 2 weeks to find this place. Couldn't find it at all. One day we were sitting on the beach having lunch. The wind blew up and our inflatable blew off the coast and started drifting out. So we sort of put a face mask on and got after it as quickly as we could. And as we were swimming after it, we looked down and there was the harbour. We just miraculously found it. And that was really exciting, finding that. And what they call amphorae, which are the Greek wine jars, still sealed, that they were carrying around in the wrecks. And we had one unfortunate incident there where a guy picked one up from the seabed, lifted it up, got halfway up to the surface and looked at his spoil, only to find he'd picked up a World War II bomb. So he quickly dropped that. But when he got to the surface, there was nobody else there. We'd all legged it and left him to it just in case it went off. And on another occasion, because we were living under in tents, we had our own water vehicle called a Bowser. And we were a bit bored one day, done all the diving, I suppose, and said, well, let's go for a drive. So three of us got in this vehicle and drove around. Got back about an hour later, and the officer in charge said, where the hell have you guys been? And just been for a drive around and see what we could find, sir. He said, you idiots. He said, you don't realise this is a minefield. You could have blown yourself to smithereens and we'd have lost all the water, which was far more important than losing you, three idiots. So that was my insight there.
Well, you survived various tours of duty as a scuba diver.
Oh, right? Yes. And, yeah.
But as you alluded, you decided that the RAF was not going to be your long-term home.
Correct.
So
correct.
How did you engineer your next role then?
It was coming back into a sort of a family business then, which was... from Cromwell I went into the Independent Airlines. I joined Dan Air.
So aviation was still
aviation was still there, and I had all that sort of logistics knowledge and working everything around the aircraft on the ground, so to speak, and the crew. So I joined Dan Air, which the acronym stands for Dangerous and Noisy, one of the largest sort of Comet fleets, and at the boom of really the cheap holiday business. And that was very, very exciting. I enjoyed that. We used to get up to lots of pranks because this was the time where holidays were at their peak and people going down to Spain for a week's holiday, etc. And what we used to do at night, we'd done all the work was out of the way, paperwork and flight plans set. We would then reserve two seats on the plane, but then take our uniforms off and go and check in as a customer. Meanwhile, what we had done on the seat back, we had put in the sick bag some large spoonfuls of potato salad and sealed them back up and put them in the back of the seat. And then we would check in as a passenger, walk through as a passenger and board. And then about halfway down the flight, we would pretend to be rather ill in the sick bag and then get a spoon and scoop the potato salad back out and eat it.
That is awful.
Which made the person sitting next to even feel even worse. And a very good friend of mine who was a captain, and I knew him at Cromwell as a pilot, he used to come out of the cockpit, this is the days before high security, with two big long pieces of string. And he would give it to the first passenger on the front row, normally a lady. And he said, can you hold these pieces of string whilst I go to the toilet, please? And she would hold it. She said, if you want to go left, you pull the left string. If you want to go right, pull the right. And off he'd go to the toilet. And the first officer was in on this, and he used to tug on them occasionally. So she thought, well, I better correct it. So she's steering the plane. Happy days.
Wait, it sounds like it's just as well that you didn't stay with Dan Airstream. It's probably a good moment to have your second track, which is the 1st Battalion of the Grenadier Guards playing the British Grenadiers. This is obviously going back to your military days.
Absolutely. I mean, I love my country. And I think one of the finest exhibitions you can see of British pageantry has to be the Trooping of the Colours. It's what we are so good at, and it makes Britain great again. I think there's nothing better than the Trooping of the Colour, and I've asked for the live version, and this is the British Grenadiers when they march up to collect their colour. Thank you.
Well, that was short and sweet. That was the 1st Battalion of the Grenadier Guards playing the British Grenadiers, and that was actually a live recording at the Tripping of the Colour in 2003, and the tune itself goes back to the 17th century, I believe. Anyway, chosen by Vaughan Matthews, my guest in the Folktale studio today. Vaughan, we got as far as you having been with Dan Eyre, and it sounds like you made a wise decision to escape from that before they caught you out. Yes. For any more pranks. But you then went into the family business, which was what?
Haberdashery.
Oh, okay.
Gosh, there's a quantum leap, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. Because of
where we were up in the Midlands, we were in the hub of the manufacturing or the rag trade industry for most of the major high street stores. And so we had a very successful business there, supplying all the any element on the makeup trade, so zips, buttons, lace, etc., etc. But we also had retail outlets as well and markets. And I thoroughly enjoyed studying on the market and meeting people. It was good fun.
You've alluded to the training which you obtained in the RAF as being having set you up for life. This is obviously completely different than anything you've done before, but I take it that training was nonetheless very valuable.
Absolutely, because it makes you work out a plan. You were always taught in the services, if you fail to plan, you're planning for failure. And this is what I brought to the company, I think, because I had that. And man skills, we had a lot of employees, so they needed managing. And I think, again, because of that basic training in the Air Force, you can go to almost most skills and take that with you because you've learnt so much about working with people, getting the best out of people, etc. And planning, logistics, all of that come together. And I've always taken that wherever I've gone. So other than the product itself, which I knew nothing about, but you just have to learn about it and listen to people. And someone told me very, very early on in the retail trade, you have two ears and one mouth. And I think that's great advice. Absolutely great. Listen to people. Let them tell you about it. And certainly when you're selling, that's what you need to know. What do they want, not what you want to tell them. And you go in some stores these days and people just don't do that. And I think it's such a shame. And you can have the best store in the world, but if the staff aren't up to it, you've got problems. And you've got to get that bit right. And if it's a pleasant experience and you think, those people listen to me, and they come out content and happy, that's a success. So two ears, one mouth, taking that with me from the retail trade.
Well, you obviously quite enjoyed working in that business because you were there 7 or 8 years, I think.
Yes,
and
yes.
Then you were headhunted.
I was headhunted by a manufacturing company that made furniture for the nursing home trade. This was really in the early days of nursing home setting up. So there was a specific requirement for purpose-made furniture so that people could sit in a chair easily and get out of it. The fabrics were up to the task, shall we say, but they still looked as if they're from a domestic sort of makeup. Planning it was also important, learning how residents move. The challenging ones, they were called in my day, EMI, the elderly, mentally infirm, and making it as homely as possible for them and allowing them to sort of live in that homely environment was vitally, vitally important, so that if they couldn't remember which door was their front door, by sitting and talking to them, right, what did you do? You were in the war, you were a pilot, you were in the gunnery, whatever, or the lady worked at a factory. Something synonymous that you could put on their door that they could memorise, that's where I live. And then designing the nursing home so that they could walk around with freedom, but be secure at the same time. So you had to understand fully what it was like to be a resident in order to do a good design. And I think we were very successful at that.
And this came at a time, this is in the 80s, wasn't it, when nursing homes were just beginning to take off.
Yes.
There was a boom, wasn't there, in those days?
Big time.
And so quite a big market.
Yes, a huge market. And, of course, the corporates came into it with multiple homes. So you can imagine, and most of the homes there were 60-bed units. So they were big buildings, and you had to get it right. And I think, on reflection, we did get it right, and the residents were happy. I would go back and talk to them and sit with them, and find out how they were enjoying themselves there. And they were good. They were looked after. They had the time as well, and they had difficulty there with stuff because they needed more and more stuff to accommodate for this demand. It was huge.
Which possibly led into your next role, which was in recruitment, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, one of my biggest customers, who had a corporate group of nursing homes, said, look, you know, I need someone to take another aspect onto my business. I want to start importing nurses because we need the staff. And I found that the Philippines have got good English-speaking nurses. Can you help me bring them back into this country? So, again, I was ready for another challenge. It was one of those wonderful opportunities. I know nothing about the Philippines. I've never been there. But I think I can do it. And I joined him, and we formed a great company going to the Philippines to bring back nurses to come and work in the United Kingdom. And it was challenging because it is a poor country and life there is tough. But most of the girls, I have to say, although there's a lot of male nurses now in the Philippines, they were mostly females. And it was a proven track to get out of the poverty trap. And to offer a Filipino nurse an opportunity to come and work in England was like winning the lottery for them. They'd made it. Because the money that they could earn, they would send probably 80% of it back home, which was an unknown income to that family. The difficulty being if they had a young child, an infant, a lot of the interview panel would feel that we can't possibly take this mother away from her child. But if you look at the bigger picture, by that nurse coming to work in England and able to send money home, and they had the family unit in the Philippines, they lived with grandmother and grandfather. They all lived in one house. So the child still had that loving relationship, but the money that was coming in was paying for that child to have a better education, they could live better. And so it was a win-win situation, and they were very happy to do that. And like a lot of countries, they produce steel or motor vehicles or chemicals. Filipinos produce people, and there was a huge amount of nurses. And towards the end, nurses were having to pay the hospitals to go and work there. Because of the job situation, and there was such an amount of a depth of knowledge from the nurses there in the Philippines that we were not denying them all of their own resources, because I was very conscious of that, and that came into other countries when I was meeting with Minister of Health, that we're not here to take away your nurse or your nurses. You must tell us what your requirements are, and we don't penetrate below that line. That was the key factor of not robbing their own resources. And that was paramount.
In turn, it brought up the standards within the Philippines as well.
Very much so.
Yes.
Very much so, yes. And they had a goal. But their goal, in actual fact, was not to come to England. No. That England was seen as a stepping stone. Mm-hmm. They wanted to go to America. Right. They very much embraced the American way of life in the Philippines. And the ultimate was to get the green card to go to the United States.
Okay, let's take a little bit of your next track. I say a little bit because it's 9 and some minutes long, which we won't manage all of. This is the Piano Concerto No. 2 in F minor by Chopin. Mm. Why this one?
Flying around the world and different timelines, etc., is very demanding. And I used to just go and sit in the lounge and I would play this piece of music and it would just bring everything down to that wonderful, calm level. And it's a piece of music that I introduced my wife to, and we both love listening to this piece of music, and it's just a joyous piece, and I think it's Chopin at its best, at his very best.
Well, Lang Lang there playing the Larghetto. That's the second movement from the Chopin Piano Concerto, number 2 in F minor, opus 21, chosen by my guest in the studio, which is Vaughan Matthews. Wonderful music, Vaughan.
Yes, I don't think it gets much better. I wish, if I could have a wish, I suppose it would be to be able to sit play this at the Albert Hall to a packed audience, because it's just divine music. It doesn't get much better.
It is indeed. Well, we left you headhunting nurses in the Philippines.
Yes.
Your next role was very much allied to that. In fact, it was really an extension of that, wasn't it?
It was indeed, because I think we'd now seen the benefits of international recruitment on a wider scale, not just from one base, so to speak. And it came about purely by me doing a presentation in Luton, of all places, and going back almost to my roots. And I did this presentation to some nurses there. And one of the girls at the back stood up and said, "You really need to go and see my friends, because they're desperate to come and work in this country." And I said, "Well, I don't know where you come from. Please enlighten me." She said, "I'm from Trinidad." And my chairman was with me at the time. And he said, "Vaughan, I want you on the next plane to Trinidad." So I got on the next plane to Trinidad and duly went down there and was swamped. The hotel was full. The police were called. They had to close the doors in the hotel. There was too many people there for fire risk. It was heaving. The television were there. They wanted an interview with me, the radio, and all these hundreds of nurses. And I'm trying to think of the figures. I think in the past year, we had recruited round about 100-plus nurses from the Philippines over the year. Now I'm in Trinidad on day one. I've got over 250 nurses want to come and work in England. It was just mind-blowing. And very interesting, because, I hadn't been to the Caribbean on a recruitment drive. And one of our sort of questions that we would always ask in the nurse, what is the patient-to-nurse ratio on your ward? And I was interviewing this nurse, and I said, gave her the question. And she said, "Well, we have 10 beds on the ward, and in the daytime there's normally 8 nurses to look after the 10 patients in the bed." I said, "Fine, that's a nice ratio. What about at night time?" "Oh," she says, the ratio goes up to 4 nurses for 18 patients." I said, "Let me stop you there. You just told me there are 10 beds on the ward." She said, "Well, there are." "Well, how come you've got 18 patients now at night?" I said, "We put 2 in a bed." Which I then went on to sort of cross-infection and all of those sort of issues. Well, you know, this is the Caribbean. Welcome to Trinidad. We don't have the bed, so we top and tail. And that was another learning curve from that. So you start to sort of look at things in a different light, and what you take for granted are not necessarily the right assumptions. So changed an interview technique and got the best out of them from that. But now we were going to every island, English-speaking island in the Caribbean. This is for taking nurses to America, because now America's got the same issue. They are desperate. And America being America, God bless them, don't recognise anybody else's qualifications. So you could be a fully qualified nurse in England, but they will not recognise you in the United States. So you have to take what's called the NCLEX, which is the American nurse exam. So we now have to bring in an education layer to our recruitment to train the girls to go and sit the exam. The next complication being that you can't take it, at that time there were only about 3 places outside of the States you could go and sit the exam. So now we have to ship them to the Virgin Islands, which was the nearest of American island, and Puerto Rico, for the exam, because it's all computerized. So that's what we were doing. We were doing online training and going down to the Caribbean to train the nurses, and then taking them up to Puerto Rico and the US Virgin Islands to sit the American exam. So that was life, living, going round and round the islands. And in fact, I was in Puerto Rico on 9/11 when obviously the disaster took place in the States, and that I was trapped there for about 4 days because all flights just stopped. And I was worried because I'd just come out of the Middle East and I had been to every single Middle East country, including Saudi Arabia, the lot. So my passport was quite hot. And I thought, they're really going to pull me into the office thing. And the Philippines, of course, which the Abu Sayyaf were operate out of there. And I thought, they're going to pull me in here because this doesn't look good for my part. And I just checked in, rubber stamped, and went through. And I even got through hand luggage with a pair of scissors in my hand luggage straight after 9/11, which was quite remarkable. So that was my experience down there.
You mentioned there that you, by this point, were doing work in a number of other countries. And before we came on, you mentioned India, Sri Lanka, China, South Korea,
yes.
Singapore.
Yeah.
So this job that you'd come into, not quite by accident, but something
yes.
completely different than what you'd
absolutely
been doing,
right.
has suddenly become a major career for you, really.
Well, if you looked at the World Health Organization, the vacancies then were in excess of 2.5 million on a global platform. So it was huge. And now it's still there. Anybody really with a medical qualification has a license to go anywhere in the world, north, south, east, west, because the demand is massive. But you've got to come back to being careful here with regards to the level of recruitment, and that's why I said I had numerous meetings with ministers of health, and especially in the Caribbean. Caribbean was interesting in that it was almost like dead men's shoes to be a nurse, because people didn't move then. They got in the job and they grew in that until they retired. So the movement was very little to get in to be a nurse. What we were now bringing was to move that upper echelon out to the States or to the United Kingdom or wherever, so that people could then move up the ladder. There's now a gap at the bottom to encourage youngsters to come into nursing, because they could see it was an international passport eventually to go overseas. So we were able to control the level of staff that they needed to look after their own, but also to create an element of it that could then go overseas. And that was very successful on the Caribbean islands.
I want to come on and talk about the council in a moment.
Okay.
You left that career in 2014.
Yes.
What caused you to take that decision?
Old age.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
I retired. I've had a great life, no question about it. I've been to so many countries, and I feel very blessed and honoured to have done that. But there comes a point, and I think when you start going to board meetings and you get very cynical, and you think, what the hell are these people talking about? All these sorts, you know, we've got the blue sky thinking and we need to grab the low-hanging fruit and do some rainmaking. Oh, please, get a life. I used to talk to the chairman because he confided in me because he thought I was his sort of eyes and ears in the office. And I said, they hate you. He said, you're joking. I said, no. I said, the dynamics of the office change. When you're not there, it's a great, buoyant place. When you're there, you know, all the air leaves. It's as bad as that. I said, you're the only man I know who can walk into a room and darken it. He said, I don't know how you dare speak to me like that. I said, you want me to tell you the truth? And we tried in Singapore very, very hard. But Singapore really didn't want to bring in foreign labour as such. They said, we do not want to be another Dubai. But they needed the experience. And they asked me for a specialist research scientist, 8 years post-grad, PhD, the lot. I said, fine, I can get you that. What's the salary you're going to offer them? He said, well, we were thinking about £20,000 a year. I said, I'll get you a taxi driver, a bus driver, but I won't get you a senior scientist for that. And that was the difficulty. I said to the chairman, I think we have to call it a day.
Time had come. Let's have your penultimate track. This is the LSO and Nimrod.
Yes. I love sailing offshore. And I think this sort of epitomises the whole aspect. And the nice thing about this track is it starts off with the sound of the sea. But halfway through, there's the weather forecast as well. And I used to love lying in my bunk on the boat, listening to the weather forecast, ready for the next day sailing. So, and I can't hear this music without crying. And I go to the cenotaph for the centenary, for the remembrance service. And I always end up bawling my eyes out. My friends all point at me. They know what's going to happen. I'm a car crash.
Well, this is the recording from the opening ceremony of the London Olympics. And yes, indeed, listen out for the weather forecast towards the end.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Northeasterlies promise me 4th, mainly easterly or northeasterly 4, occasionally 5. Fog patches, moderate, occasionally very poor. Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover. North or northeast 4 or 5, occasionally 6. Fog patches, moderate, occasionally very poor. White, poor.
Nimrod from the Enigma Variations, played by the London Symphony Orchestra at the London Olympics. And Vaughan, a very special piece, obviously.
Yeah, I think I've got something in my eye at the moment. It's just synonymous with, again, my country and England. And, yeah, it's very special.
Fantastic. Anyway, back to your story. Having told your former employer, or given him some honest feedback,
yes,
you decided the time had come to retire in 2014. But I'm imagining you didn't sit back and do nothing. We haven't mentioned thus far you are a Freemason as well.
I am indeed. I am indeed.
A lot of mystique used to surround Freemasonry, but not so much these days.
It's coming more and more into the open. It has to, like everything else. It can't keep looking back and say, we've always done it this way. The only reason it really went into the darkness, shall we say, was because of Hitler in World War II. And like many things he wanted exterminated, the Freemasons came into that category. And thousands of them were executed purely for being a Freemason, which is not a religion. We recognise all religions. There's never been a question about that. But that's when it went underground, and it's never really recovered fully from that situation. But the powers that be at the top of the organisation have recognised that we need to be out there telling people who we are, what we do.
What do you do?
That's a very good question. I look upon it as, apart from the fundraising, which we raise millions of pounds for worthwhile charities on an enormous scale, but we don't really sort of talk about it, we don't shout about it, we just do it. It is for like-minded people. There's a code of conduct, and it teaches you so many elements of life that are sadly disappearing, I think, respect being one, and discipline. Looking after your fellow human beings. You basically come into Freemasonry without any money, figuratively speaking, and you remember that you had nothing and that you're there to look after other people that are less well off than yourself. And it teaches you this element of humanity, which I think is again, lacking and diminishing. You would never pass by somebody that's in distress, and you would always look after someone that's in distress. And that's the element I do enjoy. And then there's a very strong camaraderie. There is an aspect of growing through Freemasonry. You come in with no degree and you'd take a first degree. And we play out aspects of these little plays. And you have to learn ritual. you have to be very sort of disciplined and go away and learn. And the higher up the ladder you go, the more you have to learn. And some of it, when you go into the chair, is a huge amount of work to do, but an enormous amount of satisfaction at the end of it. So everybody has a part to play, and it allows people to grow into it. And again, I would recommend it for people considering it, because it teaches you to sort of public speaking. Wonderful for that. You've got to step out onto the floor and present a piece of ritual that you've learnt by heart. And then after the actual meeting itself in the temple, there's what's called the festive board, which takes place outside afterwards, which is a meal where you sit down and you could be sitting next to a total stranger. And you talk about many things, and you have this common bond of being a Freemason between you. And it's international. I was in Dubai once, walking through the airport. I wear a little blue forget-me-not, which is our international sign, because that's to remember the Freemasons that were executed in World War II. So we recognise that on a Freemason if he's wearing that badge. And I was in Dubai, waiting for a flight to go through. And this guy tapped me on the shoulder. He said, welcome, brother. He said, are you travelling to the east or travelling to the west? I said, I'm travelling west. I'm going home. He said, I hope you're safe. Everything all right? I said, yeah, I'm fine. He said, good. I wish you a safe travel. And he walked away. That was it.
Can anybody be a Freemason?
The one question you will be asked is, do you believe in a divine spirit? If the answer to that is yes, then they will go through the other following questions. But technically, that is it. You must believe in a supreme being of some sort, because you take oaths. So you must have a Bible or Quran, or the Hindu Bible, or the Sikh, whatever their religious book is, you will take an oath on that, and that's the important element of it. And that's not a bad thing. It doesn't have to be Christian. It can be any religion. We recognise any religions, and I think this is the downside. People think we are a religion. No, we're not. We recognise all religions.
Okay, that's taking a certain amount of your time in retirement. You've recently been elected to the council.
Yep.
What was in your mind when you were considering this? Because you've not been involved in politics before, although you've probably got involved in a bit of international politics in one or two places.
Yes.
But what made you want to do it?
I think it makes me feel part of the community, which I've always enjoyed. Wherever I've gone, I've tried to do that. Even overseas, I always tried to learn elements of their language so that I could sort of be polite to them and say good morning, thank you, etc., etc. In Sherborne, because Susan and I just love being here, and we are so grateful for living in Sherborne, I think I bring so much to the table with my international experiences, my military background. If I can bring that and help someone on the council or negotiate or steer or whatever, that's a pleasing thing to be able to do and to put something in. I want to look after Sherborne. We have something special here, and we must look after Sherborne.
What do you think are the main challenges facing Sherborne Council at the moment?
It's early days for me, to be honest. I've only been to one council meeting. I suppose there's this threatening rumble of planning applications and an enormous amount of housing going up. I recognise that we must look after the young. There has to be facilities here for the young to stay here and also to buy a house here. I think, that's vitally important. We have to safeguard that element, because otherwise they're going to go away and perhaps never come back. But we also have to protect the environment, the surrounding areas. It's so beautiful around here. We have to preserve that. And I recognise, yes, there is a government mandate about housing going up, but we have to look at the infrastructure in Sherborne. We've only got so much space. There's only so many, you've only got to go and stand in the car parks in town and watch people negotiating. You know, we're limited with what we can do. And most families now, I think, are looking probably at two cars, plus the children. So you've got the knock-on is the infrastructure, the schools, the doctor surgeries, etc., 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 public transport. It just grows and grows and grows. And we have to sort of stand firm here and hard and look to Sherborne to protect her, because that's why we're here. And that's why I wanted to be a councillor, to be a part of that, and hopefully to be able to sort of look after him. And it's, I suppose, what am I going to leave behind? And if I leave Sherborne a better place, then I'll have done my job.
That's a very laudable aim. Do you think there's a disillusionment about politics? Does that pervade down to local level, or is that a national thing?
Oh, I was asked on the doorstep when I was sort of canvassing, you know, what my views were on Brexit, etc. And to be honest, I cut a line through it straight away. I said, wishing to be rude, the Westminster bubble can stay in Westminster. I'm here for Sherborne, and that's why I'm going for council. I don't nothing. Brexit, I have no say in it. I have no power to persuade or dissuade in that argument. What will be, and we have to live with those consequences. The country made a decision. I think that decision should be honoured personally. That's a personal opinion. We should go forward with that. How we go about it, that's over to the people in post. My position here in Sherborne is for Sherborne. Cut the political colours away. And as I said at the beginning, I see that around the council chamber. People are there because they love being in Sherborne.
And in your spare time, you're a wine chauffeur.
I have a very grand title, yes. Again, not one to sort of sit at home and just enjoy my retirement. I found myself a little part-time job with Majestic Wines in Yeovil. So for 3 days of the week, I get my little van. And I on Wednesdays, I sort of normally go up towards Gladstonebury and those all the surrounding areas. Thursday, out to Sturminster and Salisbury. And then every Friday, I go down to Lyme Regis and delivering wine. And they gave me this grand title, which I find so precocious, I refuse to wear the badge that says I'm a wine chauffeur. but it's a great job, and I love the product. And I meet lovely people, and I'm privileged to go to some incredible houses. And you think, wow. And it's the best job in the world that I've ever had, because everyone's pleased to see me. the deliveries that are the best are the birthday presents or gifts, because they're not expecting me. So I pull up on their drive, and they sort of come storming out almost and saying, what the hell are you doing on my drive? You know, get off my drive. Say, got a birthday present here for you. No, you're in the wrong house. You must have got the wrong address. And saying, well, there's the paper. Would you like to read it? But I'm willing to take it away if you don't want it. Oh, so sorry. It's from my daughter. It's a birthday. Well, thank you so much. So everyone's pleased to see me. and I've not been able to say that all the time.
Tell us about your final track.
Well, my final track. I don't wish to sound morose or funereal, but this is I've chosen this because I'm known for my sense of humour, my wicked sense of humour, my wife will testify. The last piece of music I want at my funeral is Eric Idle singing the Galaxy Song. And please, please listen to the very last line of this. I want people to leave my funeral service laughing their heads off and thinking, that was Vaughan at his best. And it's Eric Idle, the Galaxy Song.
Vaughan Matthews, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Terry. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour, the galaxy we call the Milky Way. galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe. Keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light, you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's bugger all down.